This is the first of three sessions on schooling, on the educational system. And I want to tell you a little bit about where I'm coming from so you think with me about it. I'm a Christian educator. I've spent my life in one form or other of church educational activity. And I'm a troubled educator. I come from a long line of teachers and preachers. Unfortunately, there hadn't been a banker type in our family since we came over from Scotland and Ireland in the 18th century, I think. But I grew up with such a faith in education. It was an obvious kind of career for me. And I've never regretted it. When I was in seminary, I thought I'd be a pastor. I'd already taught in public schools and I'd taught in a college. And I thought I'd be a pastor and would be happy in it, or would be a biblical scholar. I loved all my work in seminary until my senior year, when I had to decide which field to specialize in. And what bothered me most was the gap between what the scholars knew and what people knew and were doing. And so I thought that was the place that needed attention, and so my call led me in that direction. After my graduate work at Yale, I went back to teach in a seminary and was involved in a curriculum improvement program in the Southern Presbyterian Church. It was an ecumenical effort. There were six or seven different small denominations in on it, pretty wide-ranging. I wrote the first book for that curriculum, introducing it, and spent a good bit of my energy in the first decade of my teaching to working at curriculum improvement, at a reform effort in church education. Then when I went to our Board of Education, I spent a whole lot of energy for 4 years working at improving the structures of education in our denomination and working with the National Council and other groups to try to improve the system so that it would work better. When I went to Geneva to work with the World Council of Churches, I was in the Office of Education, and that put us in touch with Christians all over the world who were doing the same sorts of things. People in Latin America who were trying to develop popular education and ways of helping people take more control of their own lives and situations. People in Africa who'd grown up with a system of mission schools, of church schools that were highly privileged, that were being absorbed into the new national school systems of education, and all kinds of ambivalence as they lost their control, lost their ability to impose religion through them. They wouldn't put it that way, but that's what was happening. Lost their elitist character, and all kinds of odd mixtures in there. Worked closely with Christian educators and from the Eastern Bloc, particularly a close friend who lived with us for 3 months to learn good English from us, who worked with the church educators of children in the German Democratic Republic, what we call East Germany from this side of the wall. And through the years, we've kept in touch with him, and to see what happens when a system of schools that includes religion as an established religion, all of a sudden in one generation has to shift to not being established. So that experience forced me to look at education in a lot of different ways. And increasingly, I became troubled by what was happening. Come on in, maybe we need to sashay around. Can all you Bleachers fans move around, and we'll leave a little room for those that come in. So when I came back to the U.S., I worked in an experimental ministry in Atlanta that we called International Education. And it was a church effort to try to help with what you might call the new kind of mission education that's necessary. How can we move into the new kind of situation the churches face around the world cooperatively, instead of carrying over the old center of Christendom idea, sending out aid or Bibles or education or salvation or whatever you happen to package in your mission effort? How can you get around that to look at the context of Christian life in the total global scene? And that was a rude kind of re-entry into American culture. It was good because bureaucratic work inevitably puts you at a strategic level where, despite all the traffic that crosses your desk, you don't often get to work in local congregations. And to work at a local level was good for Francis and me for those 4 years. When I went back into seminary, sort of to my surprise, I thought I'd cut my academic bridges. I was glad to be in a relationship with Teachers College at Columbia University, and I work in the joint doctoral program with them from Union Seminary. It's right across the street. And I have some good colleagues there and in the Jewish Theological Seminary. In Geneva, I worked with Paulo Freire. He was in the Office of Education. And through those years, I began to get some handles of interpretation for the questions that had bothered me since I was a student. I remember, for instance, the first time I taught in ninth grade, how surprised I was that girls learn differently from boys. And that if you ask a girl a question, they were more likely to come up with the precise answer that was in the book or that you told them. Boys had a little more freedom. So if you graded on precision, the girls got the top marks. But the girls were not as free to be creative, to manipulate things. And in the first grade, I was in a school with mill kids, as we would have called them. And I very quickly began to understand class problems without ever knowing that's what they were. But different kinds of culture, different kinds of expectations. And looking back, I was impressed even then with how relatively easy it was for me to learn in school and how difficult it was for kids who didn't come from a home of school teachers where you talked all the time, where you could be curious, where you were stimulated to use big words and new words and all of that. And the kids who came from the mill village didn't have those advantages. They even had crazy arrangements that I didn't even know about, like stepmothers and stepfathers. That was my first experience with that. So that I had been accumulating a whole set of questions about what goes on in schools. And the experience with Paulo and the work that I've been doing since has been pursuing those questions. What is it that goes on in schools that deals with people? And how can we understand it as Christians? So I come with this concern. I'm just back from 6 months of theoretical work on it in terms of ideology and education in London at the Institute of Education. And this is my first attempt to put it down on some papers like this, so I apologize ahead of time for the lack of order. But I don't apologize for the concern. And I hope those of you who've been in education, which means all of us one way or another, will look back into your experiences and test them against the things I'm saying. I don't want to be confrontational about it, but I want to run it down the negative side because we so seldom see it clearly. And I want to invite you to move into that with your own experience. And I may take most of the time today, but I hope we'll have a chance for some questions, and as the week goes on, tomorrow a chance to talk about church education particularly, which I won't be doing today, and then on Friday to spend the time mostly raising questions and seeing if my experience and my analysis strikes some ore veins with you. I'll try to move through this slowly enough so you can follow it. If you want me to say some more about anything, do so. I will be conscious of my agenda and hope to finish 5 pages before the bell rings for lunch. I've told you why I'm concerned about it. My thesis runs something like this. When we started school in my generation, I started first grade in 1932. I was in the privileged minority of my generation of the human race. Most of the people who were 6 years old in 1932 did not have a chance to start school. Certainly not the kind of school I went to. When I moved from high school to college, at that narrowing part of the pyramid of schooling, I was in the privileged minority of that first privileged minority. Because out of the 343 people that graduated with me at Spartanburg High School, I think most of them went straight on into the Army and Navy, and many of them did not even go on to college or university. I never dreamed that I would not. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't go on to college. But to go to college for many of those people from other kinds of class situations was a different kind of thing. It was breaking their pattern. When one of my 15 cousins did not finish college, it was a shock that ran through the whole family. And Francis and I can't help being anxious until our youngest finally turns two and finishes college, and we hope she will. When I went on from college to advanced study, which I did immediately, I was in the privileged minority of that second privileged minority, of that first privileged minority. And when I stood up to get my PhD at Yale, I was in such a small, favored few of my generation, even in the U.S., that you can hardly get it into 1 or 2%. Now, what happened to the majority? The majority were cast out by the system, either at the school leaving age where the law let them quit, or at one of those other levels where they failed or where they didn't have enough private resources to go. And in the process, they had internalized failure, while this small minority that I belonged to had internalized success. And learning was relatively easy for most of us who got our PhDs or our college degrees, because we grew up in homes that encouraged us and that taught us how to think and how to talk and how to study the way schools paid off. But the majority of those who failed and went out internalizing that they were failures by a relatively narrow slice of what it meant to be human. Namely, a cognitive, verbal kind of ability that was not so much due to my virtue or effort, but was due to the gifts of my home and my surroundings. And the privilege to graduate with me at that highest degree level, by and large, used the privilege of that educational credential to maintain structures that, as a Christian, I want to change. And that means that the educational system has produced a favored few, or has contributed to the perpetuation of a system of privilege that bothers me as a Christian very, very deeply. And I want to talk about how that happens with you, because I think education is one of the problems that we really need to work on in this world today. Now, I've listed six assumptions, what John last night called the think with. These are what I think with. I start off from this, and I think it's helpful for all of us to try to articulate them. The first one is, this world which we human beings have constructed with all of its progress is becoming more and more unjust and harmful to most of the human race and dangerous to our very survival. And I think I deeply believe that. I think the underside of our progress is more and more apparent, and we're really living in a critical moment of human history. Second, it does not have to be this way, and it does not have to be going in this direction. This, I do not believe in fate. I do not believe the devil's got control. This mess was created by people like us, and it can be sorted out by people like us. Third, all who are being oppressed by this system all of what we might call persons of goodwill, and certainly I believe all Christians, are called as human beings to challenge this demonic trend and change the world for the better. That is, I can't presume a neutrality. Fourth, our society, with its political, economic, and social systems as they are now structured and as they now operate, create powerful obstacles to our perceiving what is happening and to our changing it by using many ideological apparatuses. And that's the first jargon term. There's an essay by a French sociologist named Louis Althusser called Ideological State Apparatuses. And in that essay he says the educational system is the main one. I'm not so sure about that. But our society has a number of different forces and structures that help keep it going in the way it's going and that block our seeing it for what it is and block our chances to change it. Five, the educational system is one such apparatus for perpetuating these obstacles to what you might call critical consciousness and effective change. And six, therefore, understanding how schooling works will help us counter its more harmful effects and use the free space we have wherever we work to get free from those harmful effects and to work to change it into a better system. Now, second, some general comments. First, education is a major industry today. Somewhere back in New York, and I don't have it with me, is the comparison of the budget spent in this country on education. I think it's second only to defense. And before we got jazzed up on more defense expenditure in the last 3 or 4 years, I think it might have been first. That is, more money is spent on education in one way or another in the United States than almost any other industry. We don't usually think of it as an industry. We usually see only a small part of it, and we're aware of this huge set of activities going. But it's a very powerful budget item in an affluent society.
And Will, here you don't mean federal taxes. You're then referring to property tax and so forth, this kind of
place. All the money spent, paying teachers, buying books, heating classrooms, building classrooms.
Tuition,
whatever.
Okay.
If you just add up the money that's spent on formal education, it is tremendous. And it involves something like 30 or 40 million people. Time you add up all the students who have to go and the teachers who teach and the administrators and the booksellers and the book publishers, and incredibly large, massive. Now the second angle on that is it's a highly profit-making institution. It profits us who are in it. And our self-interest is tied to that system. I get paid by it. My kids get educated by it, and usually, in one connection or another, I can get cheaper tuition at Presbyterian College because I'm an ordained Presbyterian pastor. It has its built-in way of rewarding the professionals who gain from it and of keeping us tied to it, so we can't raise too much fuss because we get too much out of it. But it's profitable in the book business. Tremendous profits made by school books. One of the interesting incidents in South Carolina, my state, is that back in the early part of the century when high schools were just getting going, there was a huge scandal on school books. The little board that approved certain books to be approved for use in the state was getting a whole lot of money from the publishers of those books. And in the governor's campaign, neither of the major candidates would talk about it because it was too loaded. And so the president of my little Methodist college, an educator named Dr. Carlisle, ran for governor, took off from his college duties and went on the hustings. And in those days, they went to every one of those 47 counties, or however many they are, and they'd meet at the courthouse and get up on a flatbedded wagon, and each candidate would speak, and the two main candidates would talk about all kinds of stuff. He'd talk about textbooks, and he lost. But he got enough votes that in the next governor's campaign came around, it straightened out. Well, now that was 1910. The multinational corporations are now very, very heavily engaged in textbook production and school materials production, computers, software, hardware. An incredible amount of profit is made in the capitalist system in addition to the budgeted expenditures for schooling. Or if you consider the number of people involved, you might call education the most extensive public service in our society. Probably Canada too. Same kind of situation. So first of all, education is a massive industry. Secondly, it's broader than just schools. The family is an educative force. Less important now than it probably was 200 years ago because of television and schooling. When families grew up together, working together in the farm or something, in other ages, the family has been much more important. It's very difficult for the family to beat these other forces or to be as important as we would like sometimes for it to be. The church in the Middle Ages was a major force, probably the most important educated force, very marginal today except little pockets where some of us live, and we appreciate it because we see places where the school, where church has very little educative effect on us or on our children. The media is a much stronger force than it ever was, although for the last 200 years the spread of popular press, of newspapers, of novels, of books, has created a kind of social history of its own, of education, by media that then became radio and now is television, increasingly sophisticated, increasingly targeted at perpetuating some of the things that are the trouble we're facing today. The workplace, where people work, the demands of work, the time spent getting there and getting home, the problems of checking in, of being on time, of doing it right, of being under supervision all the time, and particularly those in mechanized kinds of industries where the closer they can be to an arm of a machine, the better the production. And the dehumanizing effect of the educative routine of being in that kind of job is something that most of us in the professional class just look at from afar, and we complain about the relative drudgery of reading 47 exam papers or whatever it might be. But the educative effect of the routines of work in advanced capitalist society are very, very important in what it does to human beings, particularly when the first value judgment people have internalized from living in a society is one of failure. And most of the working class have to internalize failure because success, first of all, is measured by moving up through schooling and then by how much money you get. The peer group is a strong factor educationally for teenagers and for other people. If we are left relatively lonely, then we have a lot less protection from the bombardment of our culture on us. The police and military are an increasingly strong educated force. And if you say that to a room full of blacks, they say, "So what's new?" They know that behind the persuasive ideological ways we are shaped into conformity in our culture lies the hard arm of a police system and a jail system and a military system. And if you've ever been on a march somewhere and seen the police preparations for it and the skill and sophistication with which our society keeps trouble out of sight or keeps it down, or if you look at the fact that except for Russia and South Africa, we in those two countries have more people in jail than any other countries in the world. And if you begin to reflect on your fear of police, despite our best efforts in the five-year-old kindergarten books to say the policeman is our friend, for many people in this society, the policeman is not a friend. And a person with riot gear on and a mask is certainly not a friend of many people or of what we treasure as democratic right to protest. so that they are educative structures that we can't escape, that continually influence our lives. And in that complex, schools are one of them, an important one. Maybe not as important as they sometimes have been, but certainly not unimportant. First, education is a major industry. Education is broader than schooling, but schools are important. And third, our educational system developed as part of the Western growth process, the affluence that came with advanced capitalism in the last 200 years. Now that means that we have been able to shape our structures and our processes of education at the time of the greatest concentration of wealth that the world has ever known. When we lived in Switzerland, we looked down on the elementary school. It was a magnificent building. And one of our friends who was an amateur architect looked at it and said, that's 50% more expenditure on that building than any American school I've ever seen. Beautifully done. But you look at American schools and the equipment and the style of education, just two things to note. One is school demands leisure. And the word schola from way back in Greek and Roman days was related to the root leisure. If you're on a survival economy, you don't have time to take time off to study and think. You have to think on the job. You have to learn by apprenticeship. You have to learn by something other than the segregation of learning into a separate system. So the very fact of schooling implies leisure. And that means it implies a use of resources that somebody is likely to be paying for. In Greek democracy, it was the slave class. Very few of the Greeks were citizens. And our ideas of schooling with Plato and Aristotle emerged with the citizens, with the minority who rode on the underclass. So that somehow, when you add up the resources of the world, the amount of resources we've been able to put into the development of Western schooling in the last 200 years is a tribute to the affluence and the growth of the economy of the world, and we know how some of that affluence has been achieved at the cost of using up many of the world's resources, at the cost of using up much of the resources of human people who have done the labor to get it out. The second note to remind ourselves of is that this has given us a very expensive educational system. When the missionary movement took schools around the world, it was obvious that they could not be paid for by everybody over there. Theological education, 80% of the working pastors in India had never been in a theological seminary. They are catechists. They've been to a little Bible school training. And something like two-thirds of all the support of the formal education, of theological education in the third world, has had to be supported from the rich churches of the West. There's no way a church in Indonesia or somewhere else can support, on top of university education, which is hard for the society to support, an expensive three-year residential basis with the library resources and the specialized faculty and all the rest that we simply assume in our ladder of advanced education of church leaders in the West. And if you look at our university systems and then go to a country where they have a very tough economy, a minimum kind of economy, Guinea-Bissau or wherever, it is very difficult for them to reproduce the kind of educational system that we are teaching the world is the best kind to have, namely the kind we're criticizing. Fourthly, education then reproduces the class system, with all of its injustices and harm to people. Those of us who are toward the upper range of any class measurement, socioeconomic class, particularly those who are toward the bottom. Education reproduces racism with its harm to people. Education reproduces sexism with its harm to people, to women particularly, but also to men. And education reproduces a cultural domination that gives privilege to those who start out privileged. Now, I say all those things because those are the four key mechanisms by which capitalism continues to develop, by the manipulation of a class system, by the manipulation of racism, by the manipulation of sexism, by the manipulation of culture. Now, schools, I'm charging, fit into that pattern. And the question for us to worry about is how. How does it happen and how do we take part in it? First of all, I want to talk about the processes of schooling. What has been called for the last 15 or 20 years by some writers, the hidden curriculum. Maybe time for a shift. Everybody on the floor want to wiggle a little. The Hidden Curriculum is a book 15 years or so ago, and there's been a lot of work done along that line since. And I want to mention some parts of that in not too organized a fashion. The first is to recognize that what schooling does to people is put them in custody. Schools look like prisons or hospitals or factories. They're big places. Some of them don't even have windows. Compulsory attendance is a way we keep children and young people off the labor market, and that's been part of the motivation for the growth of compulsory education in the West. The working people wanted schools because they couldn't face the challenge of child labor, which would work longer hours and for less pay and couldn't organize and protect and fight for themselves. And so now in most of the Western countries, we force people to go to school till they're 16 or so. When I finished high school in South Carolina, they had only 11 grades. But we had to go to school till 15, I guess. And I never will forget when I taught there, I sent a boy who was misbehaving, this was my first year of teaching, to the office. And he didn't come back. And the principal said he had told him that the next time he was sent to the office, he was through. And he was beyond the school leaving age. And I never have gotten over the feeling of guilt that somehow I contributed to the ending of that youngster's education. So you who've been in education know some of that trauma. Compulsory attendance forces people into a custodial situation. And its great value to capitalism is it's cheaper than prisons or mental hospitals. You get a relatively low-paid teacher handling at least 30 kids in one box room that's very relatively inexpensive to build. And you don't need much coercion to keep them there. You have a law and you make it look like a good thing. And so we keep the restless edge out of the main traffic of society by putting them in custody. And teachers know all too well some of the drains on them of that custodial care. The second thing is that schooling teaches by the basic imposed regularities. First of all, by the arrangement of time, the schedule. You're taught to be on time, to hand in assignments on time. You have to learn how to adjust to a schedule that you do not set. And you have to do it at a very young age. We had one student at the Presbyterian School of Christian Education who never was on time. But it reminded us of how much everybody else has learned to be on time. Well, you go into an African culture or a Latin American culture, and they don't measure time that way. And yet, anybody in the Western capitalist world, by the time they finish school, they know what it means to be on time, and they know what it costs them if they're not. The pace of learning is controlled by somebody else. If I want to spend 2 hours drawing a picture, and the art session is only 40 minutes, there's no chance in the world that I can take the next hour to finish my drawing. We are packaged by schooling into learning in fragmented little pieces of time. And every teacher knows the frustration of that. Furthermore, it means that those who adjust to that pattern of learning get good marks, and those who don't get bad marks. When they opened up some schools in the late 60s and early 70s, it not only had open admission, but never failed anybody. If you wanted to stay in a course for 2 years, you could. And whenever you were ready to certify yourself, they'd give you the exam. They found that nobody had to flunk. All people needed to do was be freed up to learn at their own pace. And the little efforts at that in open classrooms with primary schools have indicated to those who are involved in it how valuable a change of pace in learning that allows some freedom of schedule can be. But because we do it with 30 at a time, and we have to kind of hit at the average, like John says, 1 foot in the boiling water and one on the ice block, and the average is okay. So that kind of scheduling pushes everybody into a kind of false pattern of learning that is not like the learning that you get in the rest of your life experience. It's an artificial arrangement that again rewards certain people who come with a kind of systematic feeling for time and penalizes others. The space is enclosed, and the model of a classroom is of a square, right angles, not necessarily nailed down desks, although we had those when I was coming through elementary school, but a certain patterning of space that has very clear limits. You don't leave this room without asking permission. I remember a Korean student I had at seminary that went sent to observe in elementary school in Richmond, Virginia, and we asked him when he came back, what was the most surprising thing? He said, the most surprising thing was that a child could leave the room to go to the bathroom without raising his hand and asking permission. But in how many American classrooms is there any freedom of movement except very limited by space? And we connect learning with what's enclosed in that space so that instead of going down the street to look at the waterworks, we'll get a television set that'll show us, or a film that'll show us what a waterworks is. And we stay relatively still. We sit on our asses to learn, partly because of the space confinement. We have knowledge fragmented as well. At the higher level, we call it discipline. Despite attempts to bind some things into social studies, the further you go in education, the more separated the fields are. Teachers control what knowledge is taught and learned and rewarded and punished. And that means that the passive learning is mainly what goes on. I succeed best if I learn what the teacher wants me to learn, when the teacher wants me to learn it, in the form the teacher wants me to learn it. I'm treated, therefore, by the system like a consumer. I consume knowledge in pre-digested pieces. And if I can regurgitate it at the proper time in the proper way, I move on. If my digestive system doesn't work that simply, then I don't move on. Now, that there's several ways to look at this. I have a cartoon on my wall from an old German cartoon that shows a pupil with a funnel in the top of his head and hair professor pouring it in. Paulo Freire in The Pedagogy of the Oppressed talks about banking education. The knowledge is like this, and you bank it in the head of the student, and then they bank it into something else, or they draw on it to use something, but basically it's that kind of process. Now, one of the loose ends of this that I've just been thinking about and don't know yet what to do with is that that defines work for us. So the difference between work and play is conditioned in us by the work is what the teacher makes you do. So that if my work is only imposed on me, then I lose the ability to enjoy my work because I never have much chance to own it. And that's very close kin to the shift in manufacturing from doing it yourself and being proud of your workmanship seeing it go by, and you never know what the ultimate product is, and don't care about quality. So that the meaning of work begins with the imposition of work tasks as over against playtime. And the work tasks are those that are imposed on you, whether you're ready for them in that form or not. Behind the teachers, who are the controllers of that classroom, are the authorities of school boards, of school principals, of state boards of education, of federal funding, of the whole textbook and equipment industry. So that very few teachers have a huge amount of freedom in determining what they teach. If their students don't pass the national tests, then something happens. The school gets graded or gets punished. And if the school gets punished, the principal sooner or later punishes the teacher who doesn't produce results by the model that's expected. And there's a good bit of writing these days that I worry about on what's called the de-skilling of teachers. That increasingly the textbook companies are putting out packets, boxes of materials that not only show you what to teach but how to teach it, and sort of program the teacher that if X response comes back, then I say Y question, and if Y response comes back, then I say Z question. And pretty soon we get the teacher looking like an appendage to the machine of curriculum rather than a human being with freedom to search for knowledge alone. And in that whole hierarchical system, we so concentrate on what the teacher knows and what the pupil needs to know that this huge array of knowledge that needs yet to be learned together is never really addressed. What we spend our energy on is the little bit of it that teachers already know, and it's in the packages, and therefore the students need to know that. But the whole business of the mystery of learning and the need to put energies together of those who are older and more mature and know certain things and those who are younger and not as prejudiced, etc. The need to work together to learn about the universe. That kind of excitement of learning is often lost in the packaged transmission from authority to authority to pupil at the bottom. The evaluation processes emphasize this and underline it. The testing system takes away from the freedom of teachers. It reinforces control of what is taught and learned. It does it by emphasizing competition, individualistic competition, as if knowledge were a scarce thing, that if I learn it, you can't have it, rather than all that stuff that's not yet known. So that when you set up a win-lose model and bring the competitiveness of a capitalist socio-economic system, political economic system, into education as strongly as we do, and set the reward and punishment patterns and future credentialing success by a competitive system like this, then you're bound to end up with individual, isolated learning. We saw this in Switzerland very clearly when our daughter came home one day, and it was apparent from the conversation that the only thing they ever could do cooperatively was cheat pretty well. And the teachers knew it and implicitly affirmed it because they saw the greater wrong that was being done by a system that sliced out X number of people at every year. The rewards go to certain skills. It's not equal. It goes to written skills over oral skills. And ever since print technology came in over the last 500 years, schooling has shifted to control of paper and print and writing. And the thing about print is it stops time. If you put something down on paper, then it doesn't keep changing. And that's why scholarship is relatively easy, because you go in a library and you don't have to worry about the continuing human experience. You can read a book and it slices time and stops it. It's what the pros call synchronic, the same time. And writing enables life to be stopped. So that long before we got into the problems of visual media like moving pictures or television, we for 500 years have been in a process of learning that concentrates more and more on texts and on linear reading and on thinking that what's organized and what's most important can be put down and recorded that way. Now, the implications of that subservience to print in the inheritance of Western education, I think we do not really know. And we're moving into a new world of television where we know even less, because we're in such the early stages of what that's doing to the way we perceive reality. In a box, rectangular, squeezed, and so forth, artificial color. It rewards written over oral, and that means that oral cultures, which tend to be lower class cultures in our society, or African cultures, or cultures without much writing, where real communication is oral. Think of the difference here with me trying to communicate what I'm saying with you in writing without your being able to see my face and perceive my emotions and see how hard it is for me to joke about it. There's no way you can read a book and relate like that. And yet even a book allows you to learn at your own pace. You can stop and reflect, which television does not allow you to do. So that the whole mechanized technological grounding of our educational processes is problematic in this sense. It rewards people in our society who are English mother tongue. Gosh, the Hispanic mother tongue people. One of my friends who's Hispanic said what the schools taught him was to hate his father because his father didn't help him learn English, and if he didn't speak English in school, he was laughed at by the kids and beaten on by the teacher one way or another. Not just English, but middle-class white English is what pays off. And one of the professors I got to know in London had done a lot of research on the different ways lower-class people use language than middle-class people. Middle-class people use it exploratory. Working-class families tend to use it short, crisp, controlled. But a greater community, less alienation than the kind of probing that middle-class people have. So that a lot of angles on that, the black English question for those who are teaching blacks and who are white and who've grown up in one cultural level, socioeconomic middle class, is over against another. Jean Anion, who's at Rutgers, has done some studies of the way different schools in that area around Princeton and that part of New Jersey, the schools that are upper class schools, private schools and stuff, teach subjects in a different way from those that are with lower class schools, all the way down to the first grade. So that the whole packaging of learning is so enmeshed in the expectations of different cultural styles and so forth. Grading, evaluation, rewards conformity as well as learning. We know what a teacher's pet is, but we also know how difficult it is for a teacher not to like more the products of those who do it the way you do it. And a student who does it a different way is often perceived as somebody that's detracting from the process of learning rather than contributing to it. And so there's a routinization that goes on that gets built into the reward system. We label people as deviants, as dumb. We don't say it, but the kids pick up what teachers do and call each other dumb if they're slow learners, or disadvantaged. And by labeling, we help cause it. And as liberal people with a vision of what's right and what's good, an average kind of thing that we'd like to have everybody become, we bring a clinical perspective, the language of treatment and pathology, into learning. We think of ourselves as helpers rather than colleagues. And behind all of this is a coercive apparatus that's in the grading system, that's in the credentialing system. So that the schools select and sort out, and as I've mentioned, the majority end up failing. And that means there's another form of control that's access to knowledge, access to the higher credential. That's the hidden curriculum. And just all kinds of ways it works. And some of them we are vaguely aware of. Some of them we are uneasy about. Some of them we are mad at when we teach. Some of them we are unaware of. And the cumulative effect of that is very powerful teaching. Now, the next one is the control of knowledge, the content of the curriculum. And I've got to move more rapidly. First of all, the stratification of knowledge. Some knowledge is worth more than other knowledge, and that comes through loud and clear. Written knowledge is more important than oral knowledge. We don't have that many oral examinations. Mental knowledge is more important than manual knowledge. And one of the stability factors of education in almost all cultures from the earliest days is that mental knowledge is more valuable somehow than manual knowledge. And one of the main things schools do is separate those who are mental workers from those who are manual workers. The technological is increasingly more important than the humanities. Think of how often you see the word training. And training implies a model that is not curiosity exploratory. Training, you train horses to jump by giving them sugar. Or you train people for a job in the same way. And again, one of the books that analyzes this is called The Great Training Robbery. And gets at the implications for what it means to be human from training a person to fit into a machine-like world. The scientific disciplines now are getting the so-called best students. Those are the ones who are labeled best by IQs and SATs, which are two of the ways that we measure human beings by a narrow slice of the wholeness of human beings. And those who turn up best go. And we're worried about that in theological education. Religion is part of the humanities. And as budgets get cut and fewer students take humanities, how can you get a job knowing Latin? So, by and large, this value system of a capitalist culture with a high, increasing amount of unemployment forces people into the technological things because that's where the payoff is, and the reward system that really counts is that payoff system. So that evaluation privileges the cognitive. It gives greater honor to the cognitive and to the rational in Western society, and a lot of it to memory. Just who can remember most and hit the right check on a multiple choice, or in an essay, cite the most facts that are somehow connected to the question the teacher's asking. And we all know that game. Those of us who've succeeded can remember well. And those who don't remember things that way, they aren't in school by the time you get to senior year in college. That means that we do not prize as much the affective learning, the emotional learning, the motor learning. It's why the right brain drawing is so liberating, because it's not what schools help us develop. We don't really know how to be creative, because being creative doesn't pay off. What knowledge is more valued is the knowledge that's already there. The knowledge of certain skills or competences, or the knowledge of certain data that you need for a certain applied job. Now that's the stratification of knowledge. The other part of it is the classification of knowledge, the specialization into specialties, disciplines, fragmented, so that a curriculum in a seminary or in a university or in a high school is a collection of things. It's not so much an integrated whole that's understood and perceived as an introduction to the larger wholeness of human life and experience together. It's a selective collection of pieces, social studies, science, etc., or Bible, theology, history, practical theology, or New Testament, Old Testament, Intertestament, etc., etc., etc. And our last 200 years have developed specialization of function so that people know more and more about less and less. And as that happens in the scholarly world where I operate, Our identity is with our field, our discipline, not with our university, not with our seminary, but with our discipline and the guild that organizes it and handles reward and punishment and recommendations for jobs that are open and et cetera, et cetera. All of that, even publication, is tied to your living in a narrow specialty. And that becomes almost a sacred identity, as if you own that turf. So we really are thinking of knowledge in this sense as separated as private property in a market economy. And we want a monopoly of our little part of it. And the last thing we want to do is get into some common learning with people who are in another specialty where we don't know much. So we are trapped in a system that pays off on what we are secure in and doesn't give us much much support for pursuing the larger things that are not boxed in these particular specialized ways. We take the mystery of learning and own it and protect it as if it were the Ark of the Covenant. Now, for students, that means they get isolated into this individualism. In seminaries, you can't specialize in everything. In the university, you can't major in everything. You have to specialize in one of these reward, payoff, narrow classification schemes. It's tied to professionalization. And by the time you put out professionals who've grown up in this classified set of specialties, then we expect the professionals to go out and act differently with lay people, with amateurs. And there's a negative tone to amateur because we've forgotten that the core root of that in Latin is to love. You do it because you love it, not because you're paid to do it. And the implications for me as a theological educator, they are very serious, because we train students in these specialized disciplines of knowledge in this hierarchical system, in these processes that create dependency, and then we expect them to go out and theologize with people, with ordinary lay people, and look at the obstacles to doing that that the system has imposed on them. Where do we look whole? Where do we see it whole? And then there's some just blatantly ideological content, and we've got to stop in just a minute. The studies of American history textbooks are the most troublesome. American history textbooks increasingly create a consensus kind of history, winner's history. The labor movement is tucked in to the good things of the advancement of an affluent economy. The bitter strikes and struggles are ignored. The struggles to get labor legislation and to get it applied well are not included in the textbook. The women's struggles for anything like equality, which were not Tea Party games, are treated as if they were delicate little cups of tea on the moving meal of American history. And it is not that way. But there have been several studies in the last decade showing that the interpretation of history in American history textbooks condition us into an ideological understanding of history that says conflict is bad, rather than conflict is the way the oppressed call attention to the need to redress some wrong. And therefore the whole system of our knowledge makes it hard for people to protest, because we've been trained that it's all going to muddle through sort of calmly, when underneath that calm is the vicious kind of struggle that goes on between power forces that does not get included in the ordinary working of a curriculum. Now, let me just close. The effects of this is to make us think that hierarchy like that is natural, is a given, and not to realize that those power structures are human creations and they can be changed by human beings. The system itself is accepted as inevitable, as a given, and we are not helped much to see that it's part of this larger political economic system that, for abbreviated forms, we call advanced capitalism, that whole system uses the educational system as part of its ideological apparatus. That on the one hand, we've got coercion. If you go too far, the police will get you. At the other hand, it's a lot simpler if you don't have to coerce people, if you can just raise them up in a system that they think is inevitable. If they use things like it's natural for people to dominate each other. If you use words like it's just a given that we got schooled, then we never make it problematic and we contribute to its perpetuation by not seeing it for what it is. The system legitimates the economic definition of human being, the differential access to culture capital, and the kind of nationalism and ethnocentrism that we're wondering if is going to destroy the world. The old proverbs, the old German proverb says, the apple doesn't fall far from the trunk of the tree. Horace Bushnell, 140 years ago, wrote that a child smells like his home. Well, we don't so much now. Everybody kind of smells like the latest deodorant. But in that process, what they were getting at without all of this elaboration is that the socializing processes and structures tend very strongly to reproduce. You don't fall far from the trunk of the tree. But the tree in our lifetime includes elaborate, sophisticated forms of ideological socialization, of which the schools are a part. Now, how can you be liberated from that? I don't really know, except what I've been saying is, I think to be more critically aware of how it happens is the first step. And then to look at the free space we have to challenge the way it works, and to use our free space to try to free ourselves and others from those effects toward changing the system where it is not so harmful. And I hope that's what we'll get into tomorrow and on Friday as we build on this analysis in a more positive way. So I hope we got some good sugar somewhere in the lunch, because this has been pretty much salt.